American Public Media.
New Year's morning, 1952. Coming from breakfast, my mess kit hit me in the back of my hand. There was an Edmund right behind me. So when I got up, my hand was bleeding real bad. And he seen me, and he said, "Sarge," he said, "come on to the dispensary, see, I can bandage that for you." Okay. So I goes on to the dispensary, and I knew it was bleeding a lot, but I didn't notice what it was. And boy, he bandaged my hand from here all the way up to here. So I get to the fire direction, and the colonel tells me, "Oh, Sergeant, you've been hurt. Take the rest of the day off." Okay, I'm not going to argue. So the next day, when he took the bandage off, I was ashamed to go back to the fire direction when I seen all of this. Well, Band-Aid would have done sufficed.
Where did you train at
Chaffee.
At Chaffee, okay. Mm-hmm. And was that an integrated or segregated camp?
It was integrated. It was just integrating the services at that time. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first group that were being integrated.
And you were never a prisoner of war, mm-hmm. And you were never court-martialed?
No.
We have a kind of a survey that we're taking of all of the mm-hmm. veterans that we're interviewing so mm-hmm. that it can all be tabulated. And mm-hmm. So for my just get this going. For my reporter, would you tell me your name and where you're from?
Okay. George Curo. I'm from Garyville, Louisiana.
And you served in what outfit?
999 Field Artillery Battalion, Korea. I was there for a year.
Do you
want to? I served as fire direction chief, or in fire direction, and became when a mid sergeant became chief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well we can sort of go back and forth.
Just tell me the story about when you first found out you were getting drafted. What were you doing?
I was working for General Electric at the time, because I just dropped out of school and worked for General Electric because I knew I was going to be drafted soon. And then I was drafted from there. And I went to the service, had training in Chaffee. And we were supposed to get 16 weeks training. We wound up with 8 weeks. Because that was right at the height of the Korean War. And we got 8 weeks training, and we got what they call pipeline to, it was to Korea. But we were told we were going to Seattle, Fort Lawton, Washington. So we went home on a 15-day pass, and then went on to Seattle. So we were humoring ourselves that we would get some more training in Fort Lawton. We stayed 3 days in Fort Lawton and was put aboard ship going to Japan. We, aboard ship, again, we were going to Camp Drake, Japan. We were going to get some more training. We get to Japan. We gets down the gangplank. We were handed our mail that had accumulated on it took 2 weeks to cross. We were handed our mail. We went to the mess hall and ate. Then we went to the supply room, picked up full field pack, helmet, and rifle, and was put back on the ship. And then this was early morning. So we were still humoring ourselves, we're going to get some more training. We rode all day on the ship, and Japan is not that big that you're going to travel all day to go from north to south. So late that evening, and we started hearing thunder, or what we thought was thunder. And but actually, it was artillery pieces on in Korea. Later that night, our names were called, my name was called, and got on the LSD, went into Korea, got on the trucks, and joined the outfit not far from the beach. And pitched pup tent. Next morning, we were assigned to jobs. I was fortunate in a way that I was assigned to fire direction, even though I had artillery MOS by being trained in Chaffee, which was an artillery base. So I had a artillery MOS.
What's an MOS?
That's your job qualification.
Okay.
And so I was trained in fire direction in headquarters. That's why I stayed the whole time. And I was lucky I served under, which is now or was, Major, what's his name?
He'll come to you.
Yeah, okay. Well, he was a sergeant at the time. And, he took me under his wings and he taught me what I should know in that area, you know. So I was lucky enough to be able to move up in the ranks, because not long after I got there, he was promoted. He was given a battlefield commission to second lieutenant. He became an observer, and then executive officer. Well, he moved up in rank. When he finally retired, he was made major. And
was he white or black?
Black. Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify, what month and year was this?
51.
But what month?
That was March.
March, okay. Mm-hmm. Yep.
March 51, and we left in March 52. And where are you from originally?
From Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
Northeast.
Well, we, down in South Louisiana, in New Orleans in particular, I left Korea on Carnival Day, 52. So that was a good carnival for me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But after we left Korea, I still had a couple of months to go. So we were sent to Fort Jackson, South Carolina, which is an infantry base. And we had over 200 men that had rotated from the 999. All together, we stayed together and were sent to Fort Jackson. And there were three artillery pieces, 105s, which is a much smaller gun. And so all of us was there to handle those few guns. Now, what we did, overhead shoot for the infantry, basic training, the guys that coming in. So we did that until I got out. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were heading into the, when you got drafted and you were heading into the military, as a black person, what kind of experience were you expecting in terms of both your, you know, experience with whites and your own career? What was the Army like for black folks at that time?
Well, like I say, when I went in, they had just started integrating. And so I was in integrated outfit up until I went to 999, and for about 3 or 4 months after I was there, then they started integrating again. But dealing with white was never a problem, because my neighborhood where I was, all of my neighbors were white. So there was no problem at all. Even though I went to a black school through elementary, high school, and college, it was all black, but there was never any problem. I got along with everybody. Even in Korea, when I was telling the guys out there, I had made corporal, and the major had told me that he had put me in for sergeant. Well, my sergeant at that time, it wasn't Jackson was his name, the sergeant that had taken me under his wings and made battlefield commission. But the sergeant that had actually replaced him, he told me one day, he said, Kiro, he said, any time that you are off duty, he said, you can take the mail truck or go on the mail truck back to Pusan and spend the day, and as long as you're back for your tour of duty, because we were pulling 8-hour shifts. So I said, okay. But the guys in my platoon heard him. And they didn't take it as me going back. It was us going back. You know? So a couple of nights later, we were off. And they told me, look, let's go back to Pusan. I think it was either Sergeant Brabson or Sergeant White, one of them. Said, he told you that we could go back anytime we weren't off. Okay, well, let's go back. But we all can't go in the mail truck. Well, Fire Direction has their own truck. Let's take Fire Direction truck. Okay, we get in Fire Direction truck. We goes back to Pusan. Coming back, which was about 4 o'clock in the morning, we get to our first guard outpost, and the guard there said, hey, you guys are in trouble. I said, the sergeant have you all down for desertion. Why would he do that? He told me we could go. Well, we had 2 outposts. When we got to the next one, the next guy told me the same thing. When we got back to the tent, our quarters, and getting ready to go on duty, the sergeant asked me where we had been. I said, well, you said we could go back. That's when he told me, look, I said, you could go back, not all your men. He said, go see the major, which was our S3, in charge of fire direction. So I went and seen him, and he told me, he said, look, he said, I had put you in for sergeant. He said, but you guys left, he said, and you were reported as being AWOL. He said, now, I can't, since the Sergeant Brabson had told you that you could go back, he said, I can't let you off without some reprimand. He said, because I'm going to have to reprimand the rest of them. So you're going to have to go with the rest of them. Okay, I guess so. So he said, you have a choice of taking a 1 rank reduction on a summary court-martial or asking for a general court-martial, and you could get shot or either serve 20 years in Leavenworth. I said, because, I mean, we were a line troop, and it was desertion. I said, well, sir, I said, I guess I'll take the reduction. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, you can also request a transfer to some other outfit. I said, no, I'll stay here. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, if you take the reduction, you'll stay on the same job that you're on, and he said, I'll see that you get your rank back as soon as possible. I said, okay, thank you, sir. So, instead of coming out sergeant, the next day I came out PFC. So, the month later, I got my corporal stripes back. The next month, I got sergeant stripes. 2 months later, he put me in for sergeant first class. Well, again, I didn't know he had put me in for that. And so I walked into fire direction that morning, and he asked me, he said, Sergeant, where's your stripes? So you just gave me those, you know? He said, yeah, I know, but he said, I'll put you in for sergeant first class. He said, wear them tomorrow. Okay. The next day, I didn't see it listed that I was promoted, so I didn't wear them again. So I went in fire direction, and he asked me again, you don't want your promotion. I said, well, I don't see it on the bulletin board that I was promoted. He said, well, look, go see the captain, who was battery commander. He said, and find out why. Okay. So I go see the battery commander, and I said, I came to see why I didn't have Mother's Stripe. He said, look, Sergeant. He said, don't you remember you just got promoted last month? I said, yes, sir. He said, and don't you remember 3 months ago you got busted? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, look, I don't promote no damn body that fast. I said, thank you, sir. Saluted and moved out smartly. When I get back to the fire direction, the major asked me, well, you got your stripe? I said, no, sir. He said, why? So I told him what the captain told me. So he gets on the phone and he calls the captain. I couldn't tell what the captain said, but I could hear him. So they talked for a few minutes. So finally he told the captain, he said, look, he said, either Sergeant Kiro will have his other rocker, because that's what we had called them, rockers. He said, either he have his other rocker tomorrow. He said, well, I'm going to have one of your bars. So the next day I had my other rocker. And I was talking to the colonel 2 years ago. And, no, it wasn't until 3 years ago in Georgia. And he told me, he said, you know, Kiro, he said, I goofed, talking about himself. I said, yeah, how's that? He said, I was supposed to put you in for battlefield commission, second lieutenant. He said, and I goofed. He said, I didn't do it fast enough, and then you got, well, I got sent back home, you know. I said, thanks, 50 years late.
Why were you allowed? Why was there any significance to the fact that you were allowed to go to Pusan, but your
yeah, well, I mean, I was the NCO in charge.
I see.
And the first sergeant, well, as they say in the military, rank has its privileges.
Okay.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
So I was their immediate supervisor.
Gotcha.
So he let me go.
When you were in the 999th, was there much discussion among you and your fellow soldiers about the fact that you were in a segregated unit, the fact that the Army was integrating?
No, well,
you know, the racial situation. I mean, was
back at that time it was especially in the South. I mean, it was segregated. You had to accept that. So, I mean, there was no question about it at the time. My two brothers were in the Army during World War II, and they were in a segregated Army. That was an accepted fact. My father was in the Army during World War I. That was an accepted fact. It was a separate Army. Even in school, with a segregated school. I was telling some guys in the VFW not long ago, and if you remember, if, I don't know if you know it or not, up until 20 years ago, blacks were not allowed in the VFW or American Legion. Simply because they were black, although they served in all of the wars, but you were not allowed in the VFW or in any of the veteran services. But in school, in elementary school and all, and I thought books came with pages missing because we got the books that the white kids had gotten through with. After they had torn pages out after 2 or 3 years, they were sent to our school. The only way you could do homework, you would have to get together with 2 or 3 kids to see if what page you had in your book in order to do your homework. And That was throughout elementary school. Now, when I went to high school, I went to a private school, Gilbert Academy in New Orleans. And that's where I finished from, and from there I went to Xavier University. But that was altogether different. Of course, it was still the segregated schools. But in elementary school, it was, even when they first started fighting integration as such, and they were talking about separate but equal, there was nothing equal, no? But again, at that time, you were brought up with that, and it was an accepted fact. You did that. And all of the laws were stacked against you. There was one teacher I can remember. After I was, I must have been in college at the time, but she was an elementary school teacher, and she asked her students to write an essay, if you want to call it. What would I do, or how would I like to be president of the United States? And she was fired because no black kid should think about being president of the United States. This teacher was fired. So you know how bad it was at the time.
But at the same time, this was a time of change for the Army because it was being integrated. And in fact,
yeah, well, this was in the 50s, yeah.
Your outfit was sort of integrated in the reverse way. It was whites integrating
into the blacks, yeah.
Well, how did the blacks take that? I mean, would they have preferred to stay an all-black unit, do you think?
I think they would have preferred staying an all-black unit, but they went along with it. As far as I know, there was no conflict because when I got ready to come back to the States, I had to train my replacement, which was a white fellow. And I was told that he had had training at Fort Sill, which was, again, an artillery school. And I was told by some of the other guys, white guys that was with him, that he was a real dummy. He was hard to learn. And that was my replacement. So what I did with him, we had the charts in fire direction. And all of the red, little red markers were the enemy, Chinese. The blue markers was American troops. Well, that was the clear line drawn. And they were about 2 inches apart. And for every battalion in blue, in red, there was an army of Chinese, which was 50 times the amount of people that were in blue. So I took him to that chart, and I said, look, this is you. This is the enemy 2 inches away. And in 2 weeks, I'm going to be gone. So it's up to you to keep that red line from crossing into your blue line. He learned fast. So it all depends how you teach somebody.
Did he have any trouble with the fact that you were black?
No. I have never had any problem racially with white or black at no time. My wife has, even though she went to a all-black school, she said she had, now she was in New Orleans. She was from New Orleans. And well, you've seen her out there. Well, she's basically the same color I am, with straighter hair. And she said that she had problems with a lot of the black girls that came from the projects. And they said that she thought or was thinking that she was white and was better than them. And she said she had a lot of problems with that, with the blacks, not with the whites. Of course, she didn't have any contact with the whites. But again, in where I was brought up, my neighbors on both sides were white. I was going to one school, and my neighbor, who was white, was going to another school. So we playing one day. He asked me, he said, why are we going to different schools? We were about in second grade at the time. I said, heck, I don't know. Yeah, I didn't. He didn't know, you know? and we were still neighbors. Our kids grew up playing with one another, you know, and now the grandkids are there. Well, of course, my grandkids are off, but I mean, he has his grandkids are there. But we get along like one big happy family, you know. We've never had any problem.
Was your experience? Did you have any experience like in the Army with the 999th that was sort of like what your wife experienced with black students? In other words, was there anybody who looked at you, any fellow black soldier who looked at you and said that?
I have never had any problem.
Yeah.
Now, it may be my personality. I have the type of personality that would get along with people, you know. But I have never had any problems through school, from elementary school on. And the darker black guys, never had a minute's problem with them. And, but like I said, with my wife, again, she was brought up in New Orleans, I was brought up in the country. And never had any problem.
Did you ever have any experiences in the Army where you were mistaken?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
For being white.
For being white.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell any of those stories?
Again, going into some of the joints, you know, in South Carolina. The guys that I was with, the white guys that I may have been with, they knew who I was, you know. But when they go in the joint, they just wouldn't say anything, because 9 times out of 10, they would have gotten, I would have gotten in a fight, you know, because they wouldn't have want me in there. I remember, well, this is way after I was out of the service, and while I was on vacation in Mobile, my wife and I and my two kids, and it was raining hard that night, and my wife said she wanted something to drink. So I went into the bar and got a drink for her. And there were two white guys sitting on one end of the bar. There were about four whites sitting on the other end of the bar. Well, I stopped right by these two whites. And one of them started talking with me. I started talking. And, these two were drunk. And so I got the drink and was getting ready to leave, and one of them said, well, look, he said, why don't you stay and have a beer with us? All right, I wasn't in a rush. I said, okay. So I got a beer. We started talking. One of them looked down the bar, the one that had invited me to the drink. He looked down the bar. He said, look at those guys over there. He said, they don't like us talking to you. Let's go over there and get in a fight with them. Now, I said, I'll see you. I'm leaving. I'm the only black guy in there. If the cops come, who's going to get arrested? Me. You know, they're not going to ask any other question. I started the fight. See, I'm the only black one there. I started the fight, regardless of what. I'm getting arrested. So I moved out of there. Usually that's how I would handle myself whenever I was with any of those guys. But like I said, I never had any problem as such.
Was there any, I understand that you didn't have any problem, was there any talk among you and your fellow soldiers about fighting for the U.S. when there were still such strong Jim Crow laws back home?
No. They look at it this way. This was our country. We were fighting for our country. Although we weren't we were considered second-class citizen, we were still fighting for our country. And that never came up as to what we were doing and why we were doing it. Let me show you something here. This is my oldest daughter. I got a nerve problem. Well, this is me and my wife and my two daughters.
Mm. Beautiful family. Mm.
Mm. Always, whenever somebody would ask, you didn't have any more children? No. Nope. If I'd have had more children, I'd have to put more water to the beans. I couldn't afford more beans.
Right.
So that's what you were fighting for?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, at the time there was also talk, there was some controversy over whether black soldiers were as effective as whites. You remember the controversy around the 24th Infantry and
yeah.
what did and didn't happen, what stories did get told and what didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, like with the Tuskegee Airmen.
That's right.
No, I had no problem. The guys didn't, like I say, it was an accepted fact. All of the laws were built up against us. And it isn't like it is now that you have some black legislators in the legislature or in Congress. You had nobody fighting for you. I remember one guy when I was at work, and he had gotten a ticket for speeding. It was a black policeman that had given him the ticket. And he told me, he said, George, he said, I bet if that was you, this black guy wouldn't have given you a ticket. I said, no, why you say that? Well, you black and he's black, he wouldn't. I said, oh. I said, so what you were telling me, before there was a black policeman, you wouldn't get a ticket from a white one because you were white. And I would automatically get a ticket because I was black. No, I'm not saying that. Yes, you are. You know, he's assuming right off of the top that he got this ticket because he was white and it was a black policeman. No, I can't find it.
What's the picture show?
Well, it just was a picture of my mother and my sister. Mm-hmm. But my mother's parents and, my mother, and all looked just like white. Her parents and grandparents came from France. My father's parents came from France and married Indian. That's where I come up with this. And although my grandfather married a black woman. That's how the black got into the family.
Mm-hmm. So is your grandfather.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you think the fact of the military being integrated, how do you think that in the long run affected black people? Like what effect did it have on black people and society in the United States, do you think, that the military was finally integrated?
Well, I think they were glad for that. I mean, it basically started with the military, with Truman integrating the services. And there was one guy that I knew that was that belonged to my VFW now, black guy. He was in the Navy during World War II. And in the Navy, the only thing a black person or a Puerto Rican could do was to be a cook or a servant to the officers. That was their duty. And he was asked one day, we were having a luncheon, and one of the white guys asked him, Henry, he said, you were in the Navy? He said, you were a cook, weren't you? He said, yeah. He said, I didn't want to be a cook. He said, but I was a cook. You know, there's a difference whether you want to or not. You know? He said, but I was a cook, not that I wanted to be, which means he wasn't a cook now. But I was fortunate, I guess, in a way, that my parents, seeing that I had an education, I dropped out of school because I wanted to drop out of school. They didn't want. I guess I'm satisfied with my life as it has turned out. I enjoyed the service while I was there. And I tell most people now, young people, that I didn't want to go when I went. But now that I've gone, I'm glad that I went. Because as experience you can get in the service, you can't get anyplace else. The type of people you meet and the things that you do. And you can't get that in just ordinary life. I don't know if you ever been to the service. No? You miss all kinds of experience there.
Well, it sounds like from what we've been hearing that the 999 had a special camaraderie.
Yeah.
And I want to just go back to something, and I know you've talked about how whites and blacks in the 999 got along, but can you tell us a story of what it was like when whites first entered the unit? When they first joined the unit?
Well, do you remember those first days? It would be hard for me to give an opinion on that because these guys out there that were in the firing batteries, they said that we in headquarters had a sheltered life, and especially fire direction. We had the one job to do, and that was it. We pulled no guard duty. Like the rest of the outfit, they pulled guard duty, they pulled KP and everything else. We had this one job, we didn't do anything else but that. So they said we had a sheltered life. But the guys in fire direction, and also I'll say the cannoneers, the guys on the gun, they were good. It was before integration and even after integration, they were real good. They knew their jobs. There was an incident I can remember where one of the forward observers, he was on a hill and observing enemy movement, but they spotted him. So they were coming up the hill to capture him. Well, he realized what was going on. So he radioed, it was he and the Jeep driver. So he radioed back and said that he had spotted enemy, and he gave us the coordinates. So we checked it on the charts and said, you made a mistake. Those are your coordinates. So yeah, I know. He said, they were right around me. He said, I'm going to take cover and fire for effect. So we trained all of our guns on him, blasted all around. And got the Chinese to back off, and he got back on the radio, and he said, now, okay, walk me out of here. So he was given coordinates, and we started firing around him until he got out of there, which, again, was good on his part that he could give the type of coordinates that he get, the fire direction men, that they could transpose that, and the cannoneers, that they could use that information to give exactly what he wanted.
Actually hit the target.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In other words, we were missing him. We were firing
right.
all around him
yep.
while he was walking out.
Mm-hmm.
He strapped the radio to the driver's back, and he was giving the coordinates as he walked.
Mm-hmm. Is that guy here?
No. Mm-mm. Mm-hmm.
That does it, unless there's anything else you'd like to tell us or you think people should know about the Korean War, about your particular experience in it.
Well, I had described the Korean War as a football field on a rainy day, the 38th parallel in particular, because they had pushed the Chinese back, Chinese pushed us back, we pushed the Chinese back, and you know when you have two good football teams on a rainy day and that center is muddy, everything was leveled. You know, there was no houses or nothing. Everything was just knocked out. Well, one of the things that really lasted with me, though, was the small kids. That their homes were bombed out, their parents were dead, and this ranged in area, age from 4 to, say, 11. And our 999 was the only one that was feeding those kids, because in Korea at the time, it was the survival of the fittest. And when we would move, well, we always moved at night, but when we would move, they were either in a bombed out house or something like that. When they would come look for us, we were gone. And then they would have to start looking for wherever we were. And there were a lot of times that people would ask, you see 999? You see 999? Well, they wouldn't eat until they would find us. We'd give them food. In the wintertime, we'd give them clothes. And that was the real rough thing about it.
Why do you think the 999s did it and other people
wouldn't? I think most of the American outfits did it.
Oh, I see.
It wasn't just the 999.
Oh, okay.
I think, but we were in a Korean sector.
Got it.
The ROK sector, and it was the ROK Army
right. That
was there. And it was us and the 73rd Tankers. It was another American outfit that was there. And we were the only ones that would feed them. The ROK outfit would not feed them.
Republic of Korea.
Oh, I know. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering why they wouldn't. You were saying it's because it was a survival of the fittest. Why wouldn't they feed them?
They were looking out for themselves.
They didn't have
yeah.
the same.
Yeah, they, no, the same their supplies and everything was not like ours.
Gotcha.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, we run a supply truck back to Busan and pick up whatever we needed and it came back here. But with the ROKs, they didn't have that luxury.
Great. Well, thank you very much.